Hi, my name is Adam.
I'm Bridget.
And I'm Johnny.
And
we have never seen Singing in the Rain. I pluralized it for us. I'm sorry.
No, there's no wrong way to do this. Everybody, to another episode of Fine, I'll Watch It. You heard all our names up top, so we won't go through them again, but this is the show where we show somebody, anybody, sometimes three people, a movie they have never seen before that they probably absolutely should have. So as you heard, we have all not seen 1952's Singing in the Rain, so we are going to put our eyeballs on that this evening for the very first time. This will also be our very first musical episode, because every good show deserves a musical episode, though usually it comes in the seventh or eighth season when they're really clamoring for new ideas. But I am excited to hear what you guys have to say about musicals in general before hopping into this classic that we are all watching for the very first time. So this one was picked by Bridget. Originally, it would have been your turn on the hot seat, but we're going to share that hot seat with you. So I'm going to start with you, Bridget. What do you know about Singing in the Rain, and how do you feel about musicals?
I'll start with what I know about Singing in the Rain. I think the theme song a little bit, because it's a tune that my grandmother would kind of sing like while she was dooting around the house, like babysitting us and stuff. I know that Debbie Reynolds is in it. I know that Gene Kelly is in it. I know that there is singing in the rain.
Yeah, it's a very literal title as far as I know.
Yeah. I believe it's one of those big Hollywood movies that's sort of about Hollywood too, which are always fun when they're done well, those sort of insider baseball. But that I'm not even sure of. And that is basically it. I don't know how this missed me, because I know this is one of my grandmother's favorite movies. My mother loves this movie. I came from a really big musical family. My mother loves the theater and musical theater in particular. My stepfather is a musician. Like, we would go see shows pretty regularly. But this one just slipped past. But we were big, like, Jesus Christ Superstar was a big one for us, and West Side Story, which we were talking about a little bit before we came online. How about you guys, Johnny?
Yeah, I mean, I think almost inherently, I had to like think about it, but I think a lot of us growing up just watching Disney movies, they're just inherently musicals right off the bat. So I think it's kind of built into everyone's DNA to sort of expect a number after so many minutes, and then no number, then another number. Sound of Music was a big one in our family, particularly, not getting too deep into it, but it correlates to a lot of stuff that my grandparents went through in World War II and fleeing countries. And my grandfather used to play the guitar, and he knew Edelweiss, and it's my mother's favorite movie, and it was my grandmother's favorite movie, and my sister's favorite movie. So it's that movie in particular has a lot of DNA in our family. As far as other musicals, I've enjoyed, if I hear a musical, I'm not turned off right away, because I do enjoy a lot of it, especially some of the new ones. I liked La La Land. I liked
Let's save jazz. So it's good that you like jazz is on the way out. And Ryan Gosling just really came in and just saved the whole genre.
Yeah, I can't think of so you have La La Land. I guess you could bring up some like corny ones, even it's not really musical, but like the South Park movie, I guess it's a musical in some way or another.
It's not far off.
Yeah.
Like, at least because to me, there's two different kinds of musicals. There's the Les Mis's of the world, where every single spoken line is sing-songy or melodic in nature. And then there's ones which I think this is more akin to, where it's regular dialogue, musical number, then more regular dialogue, then musical number. And South Park the movie does kind of fall in line with that. Here's that a
framework,
scene,
yeah.
Here's a musical number. Here's another scene, crescendos with a musical number. So, like, I'd be hard-pressed to argue that it's not, and I would love to see, like, some musical diehard try to be explained that, no, the South Park movie is a musical, whether you want it to be or not.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the twisted inverse of Howard Ashman, just flipped.
But yeah, you know, Rocky Horror Picture Show, I think our father made us watch Oliver at some point. Don't remember anything from that. But yeah, I enjoy them. I don't think it's kind of one of those things where it's like someone, maybe like a guy would say, oh, it's a romantic comedy, I don't want to watch it. Like, I'm not turned off by musicals. I don't have a ton of, again, one, I haven't been to a lot of like Broadway plays or anything like that. So I don't have like that type of exposure where it doesn't sort of segue into the medium of movies for me. Mm-hmm. I did want to try and go on to the Book of Mormon at some point.
It is good.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I hear. But look again, I would like, okay, so like The Wizard of Oz, I really enjoyed. I guess you could call that a musical.
Yep.
So as far as Singing in the Rain, is it singing with a G or is it slang singing?
I think it's singing with an apostrophe.
How cool. The only thing I know is just that one little line, like Singing in the Rain, how glorious a feeling, happy again, I believe, is the line. And beyond that, I believe it's in color. I see three people with umbrellas dancing or slinging or flying around a light pole. Yeah. And that's it. But I am excited for it. It has been a movie that is constantly popping up on AFI's top movies and things like that. So there's obviously a lot of good things going for it. And I think beyond just the musical element of it. So I'm sure there's a lot of good production values and maybe some good acting on the side. So, but Adam, what's your experience with this?
So this movie, you touched on the one thing I know about it, which is the guy on the lamppost with the umbrella in his hand. That may or may not be while he's singing the main tune. I'm not 100% sure, but that's pretty much all I know. Like, as a kid, I would jump on lampposts and spin around, and I feel like even though I've never seen it, like, I didn't pull it from that, but it's one of those things that has permeated popular culture that I would have known how to jump on a lamppost with one leg and hold it with one arm and spin around it somehow. Like, it's just, I guess it's just the thing that you pick up through osmosis as a child. Because I've never seen this movie, obviously, as we discussed, and I didn't really grow up in a big musical background. Like, it's not that my parents don't like my parents like music. We just never really watched musicals per se. Some of the ones you guys have mentioned, like, I've never seen Oliver. I've never seen The Sound of Music. I fully understand that it's everyone's like, yeah, I know Bridget's eyes are lighting up. Yeah. That's another one where, like, it's like Pulp Fiction for me, where it's a lot of people's favorite movie. And it's so permeated popular culture that, like, I know the basic beats of how everything works. Like, I understand the Von Trapps and Nazis and Austria and, you know, these are my favorite things and running in a field. Like, I get all the beats of it. One day I will put all of those little tidbits of things together to form a watching of the movie, but that'll be for another time. But I do, like, in more recent years, I've had more of an appreciation for musicals. Like, I've been to shows on Broadway. I've seen, Les Mis both on Broadway and the movie. I saw the Cats movie last year just out of sheer curiosity, because how do you not watch something that looks like that and has such a train wreck following with it? So I have seen that. I've seen like Newsies both the movie and on Broadway. I saw the Spider-Man musical on Broadway. So
did you really?
I absolutely did.
You're like one of maybe 1,000 people who saw it.
Yeah.
Holy shit, Adam.
I have.
You can't be like, I'm not a big musical. I don't know if I'm a big musical but I saw. But I did see Spider-Man Into the Dark.
Just turn off the dark.
Oh, Turn Off the Dark. Thank you.
I didn't see any of the trouble performances where someone got maimed or decapitated or anything like that. I saw.
Oh, that's just, right. There was some sort of controversy or some sort of accident that happened with that, right?
The high wire acts in that musical are some of the most impressive things I've ever seen on any stage.
Yeah.
So that's why I said in more recent years, I've gained an appreciation for both musicals and the theater. So I think probably growing up, I would have been like, ew, musicals, no, and been more turned off to it. I'm excited. There's a lot of musicals coming out this year that I'm looking forward to seeing. You know, I try to catch shows when they come around touring. I've obviously been to Broadway a handful of times. The Book of Mormon is fantastic. Johnny, I recommend that you absolutely see that. So I like musicals. It's not, again, not my first genre that I'm going to go to necessarily, but I've seen a lot of the newer instances of musicals being put to film. Some of the classics that I've seen Bye Bye Birdie. I remember watching that in school. I'm trying to think of some of the other like Fred Astaire type musicals and things that would have come out. And I don't have any off the top of my head, but this one just, again, it's, I know it exists. I know the main tune, but I've never seen the whole thing. So I'm excited to see it. I think the appeal of the musicals is obviously the music. So I want to get your guys' kind of take on this is, can you enjoy a musical on the music alone, or will a bad movie surrounding it pull you down from it? Like, where do you guys think in the balance of story and acting versus just like, I'm here for the music. The music was awesome. I could care less about the rest of it.
Yeah, I think I'm definitely more in that camp. You know, I can think of certain soundtracks, like the Wicked soundtrack was in heavy rotation for years before I ever saw it, like in a production. Same with Jesus Christ Superstar, Phantom of the Opera. You know, in some ways, I'm more of the person who might get a sort of attached to the score and the music beforehand, and then the movie, the visuals, the performance, whether you're seeing it live or in a filmed version, in some ways it's just either gravy in that it makes it better, or you just kind of ignore it, depending on who the performers are too. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get like a real doozy. I'm trying to think of someone who was ill-equipped, like a Russell Crowe.
Mm-hmm. Like, out of his depth. To be fair, he tried real hard. He did the live singing. You got to give him that credit. It's not his fault he was cast.
Yeah, it's not. That's true. And it cast against Hugh Jackman, who is very like
traditional like, song and dance man.
Yeah, like you're playing horse against Michael Jordan. That's not fair. Don't do that. It's not right. But that's how I feel. How about you, Johnny?
Yeah, I don't know if it'll be a deal breaker for me. I suppose it might be, just because I think a lot of what musicals, it's not just the music itself, but it's in lieu of a conversation or an inner dialogue that like the character's having. So I think for me, it has to have the same weight in gravitas that it would have like with just non-musical conversation or dialogue. So I think it definitely has to sort of keep the story going. But I think for me, more than anything, I think with musicals that end up doing pretty early on for a lot of people is they cast a spell on people and you get swept up in it like right away. And you kind of just like are victim to watching the rest of it because you just can't, you're tapping your toes. You're snapping your fingers. You're just, it, at least not for like darker musicals, but for a lot of like wholesome musicals, it just, you can't help but like fall in love with what's going on the screen. Mm-hmm. And cause it's just so innocent and it's so of its time. And I know obviously there are darker musicals and things that just go in directions that is good because it moves away from sort of like, you know, the lighthearted maybe musicals that people are the Mamma Mia's of the world. Mm-hmm. But,
yeah, for every Mamma Mia, there's also a Repo, the Genetic Opera or whatever.
Correct, yeah. But yeah, for me, I find that every time I watch a musical or a good musical is that I ended up getting swept up in it. And a lot of the things that I would typically critique in a movie sort of fall by the wayside because it's just, I try to imagine what it would look like on a stage. So again, the sets can be a little forgiving, and some other elements of it where you would maybe critique it if it was like, okay, this is on a sound stage, this is that. So for me, I'm kind of like maybe virtually watching a play, and that's kind of how I'll watch it, is if I'm in like in the audience. But yeah, I don't know. I suppose if it doesn't do that for me right away, I might be miserable the rest of it, but I don't think I'm going to have that feeling with this one.
Yeah, I have to assume it's a classic for a reason.
And, right.
I don't think necessarily that the, like, oh my God, the dialogue, you guys, and the emotion in those talking scenes are out of this world. It's going to be about the music and how it gets you there. And to your point, Bridget, I'm the antithesis of you in terms of, like, you talk about listening to things before you've seen it and, like, falling in love with the music. If I have any interest whatsoever in seeing a musical, I will not listen to it first. Mm-hmm. I want to, you know, for some of the same reasons why I think you can get a little trepidatious going in, I don't want to get attached to the original cast recording if I'm going to be seeing Touring Company Number 3 come to local Hartford theater stage, you know?
That's, wise.
So, that's just kind of how I don't, beyond the theme to this, I don't think I've heard anything else from it. And I mean, I didn't listen to any of Hamilton when it was big 4 or 5 years ago. I heard it for the first time when I watched the, like, Disney Plus version of it when it came out. Same thing with Book of Mormon, same thing with, like, Wicked. I never heard any of those beforehand. I wanted to go in kind of as fresh as possible. So seeing this today is kind of like how I would normally go about it, of like, I don't want to hear anything, I don't want to know anything. Like, let me just go in and let them tell me the story and whisk me away and provide all the magical elements that a musical can bring.
I suppose you can slice that thought right in half with something like Across the Universe, which is like, know all the Beatles songs and you're going into it seeing how they sort of revamp it and change it to the story. Because I remember I was dating a girl in college who was just obsessed with the movie, and I ended up just like was forced to fall in love with it because I just had to watch it so many times. But I actually did really enjoy the movie, and I enjoyed a lot of the takes and the versions of those Beatles songs in them. And some of the songs that I typically don't enjoy from the Beatles, I enjoyed in that version of it, believe it or not. And none are really completely coming to mind right off the bat, but I thought it was really well done. And then I understand that it actually went from being a musical movie to being an actual musical, opposed to the other way around. Am I right on that? I don't think Across the Universe was a play first.
No,
it definitely wasn't.
Yeah.
It may have moved to the stage eventually. And like those sort of like jukebox musicals like Mamma Mia,
Moving Out,
American Idiot, have gotten really big. Let's see. Just to satisfy my own curiosity.
I think Julie Andrews, who am I trying to think of? I forget who did the movie.
Oh, Julie Taymor.
Julie Taymor. I knew it was a Julie, some sort of Julie. But
she's one who did the Spider-Man musical too, right?
Yes.
I feel like she was the director of, with Bono and the Edge on music. Mm-hmm.
And she's responsible for the Lion King Broadway show as well.
Mm-hmm. Wow, okay.
Yeah, she's...
She knows her musicals.
That she do.
Yeah. No, that was a good... I forgot about it. I always forget about Across the Universe, but I remember when that came out, I was really into that as well. Just because it is cool to see songs that you know and then watch them be remixed to tell its own version of a story.
Yeah, because a lot of those songs too never, music videos weren't particularly popular back when the Beatles were around. They weren't even really around popular in the 70s. Mm. So it was kind of cool to sort of visualize some of that stuff outside of like D.L. Submarine and some of the other Beatles movies.
Yeah.
Help. So I suppose that sort of is like a hybrid of what we're sort of been talking about. Like you either you don't know the music going into it, but this you do. And
But the context is important too, which I mean, that's why a lot of people can listen to musical soundtracks ahead of time, is because, you hear these songs, in whatever order you're hearing them, whether it's shuffle on Spotify or you're listening to the album start to finish. But the context is really important, and watching those in context can elevate them even more. So you can take something that you like or love and put it up on another pedestal by watching it in the context of the show.
Now, I don't do this, but I'm wondering if you guys do this. Do you guys have like a mix of musical numbers or songs that you listen to like on a semi-regular basis, or do you have any some emotions when you're listening to some of these versions from plays that you they're telling the story, but it's more obviously very visual because you're looking at the stage and you remember it?
I feel like the closest I would come to that is every once in a while I'll be on like a Disney kick and I'll go to the playlist of all the best, you know, songs from Disney movies. So it'll just run through your Aladdins, your Lion Kings, your Little Mermaids, Hercules, all of these, you know, these classic songs from classic Disney movies, the Mulan soundtrack, you know, the bangers from that. And you go through and like every once in a while, you just throw that, you'll throw those on. And that those will be good to listen to, but I don't know.
Like, I remember being like Rent being wildly popular on CD. Like all the girls had like the Rent CD or whatever. So like, I guess that's kind of where I'm moving towards. Yeah. Like, did you pick up the CD and listen to it so much that you just visualize the whole story and the play in your head or the movie or whatever?
Yeah, Rent was a soundtrack that I had before I had seen the play or the movie. I ended up seeing the movie first. But yeah, like I could never like shuffle songs. Like I don't want to hear Tonight from West Side Story go into like.
Yeah, I would imagine you want a more linear
Pontius Pilate's Lament. Yeah, but like every once in a while, I'm like, I want to go back to this. Like around Easter, Jesus Christ Superstar gets heavy rotation. The Prince of Egypt soundtrack too also rocks. Yeah, just every once in a while, I'm like, you know what? I'm in the mood. Let me go back to this.
Yeah, so. I think I'm not sure, but I think the Lion King soundtrack is still the most popular Disney soundtrack. Don't quote me on that, but I just for some reason that one sticks out in my mind because everyone loved the Hakuna Matatas and the Wannabe King and all that stuff. But yeah, it's interesting. Like I'm pretty excited for tonight because I think I have been like slowly really enjoying musicals and appreciating them more. Like Adam said, like, is your boy like musicals? Nah, I want to watch, you know, Kung Fu or Power Rangers or something with some sort of nunchuck in it.
more movies need to have nunchucks.
Movies need to have nunchucks. But I'm glad that I've sort of opened up and had, you know, broadened my horizons, if you will, with things like musicals. I hope after tonight, I want to go and watch like older musicals because I know they're just like the golden age of Hollywood. It was just, you had them like half of the stuff that you saw in theaters was like musicals and the other half was like narrative stories. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they've definitely had their time. And, you know, it's one of those things where we talk about all kinds of different genres. We talked a lot about this with Westerns is that they come and go, you know, they have a heightened popularity, then they dip for a while and somebody tries one and it's not very good. And then that puts the whole, you know, the whole town on against it for 10 years. And then a good one comes out and that's when everybody goes rushing to try to find the next adaptation or the next one that they can pull from. So yeah, I'm excited for it too. There is just something about watching people have fun and smile and sing along.
I know. After Mystic River, we needed something light.
Yeah.
We needed some smiles, some songs.
For such a dark movie, I don't think it rained once in that movie either, so.
No, it didn't. We need some rain.
Yeah. Despite my assertion at the beginning that the one scene I knew was Sean Penn in the rain.
It didn't happen.
So I need some rain, goddammit.
Yeah. We're good. You were promised rain.
Yeah. I want rain now, so I think we're about to get it. So, any other last minute thoughts before we go ahead and put our dancing shoes on?
Yeah, I'm ready to get wet.
Fair enough. Yeah. All right. Well, then, what do we have to say for ourselves? Fine.
I'll watch it. Not bad.
Yeah, I think we got it.
Getting a little better at it.
Yeah.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. come on with the rain. I've a smile on my face. I'll walk down the lane with a happy refrain, just singing, singing in the rain.
All right, we are back. We have all just finished for the very first time the classic 1952 musical film, Singin' in the Rain. So, as I said, we have all just watched this for the very first time, so we are going to get instant reactions from everybody. But Bridget, this was one that you had picked, so I want to start with you. How are you feeling? Are you, as well, singing in the rain?
I got to dance right now. This movie was delightful. I'm glad I went with this because the other choices, the other batters on deck were a little bit darker. This was just a lovely little confection of a movie. The dancing was great. I laughed more than I expected to. Delighted. How about you guys?
Johnny, what about you? What's your instant gut reaction here?
My instant gut reaction is I enjoyed it. I was enchanted for a good stretch of the middle of this movie, and then I have like a serious issue with it in the latter third of it. I will say this movie is the Mortal Kombat of musicals. It just like it hits so hard right in the beginning. Like, we're talking about, oh, when are we going to see Rain? When are we going to get a musical number? Boom, right there and then.
Big bright raincoats.
Yeah, right.
The water machine, the works.
Yeah, no time doing the title drop there. Yeah. But I don't want to spend too much on it, but yeah, I did. I overall enjoyed it. What about you, Adam?
I really liked it. I liked it a lot. I thought it was really fun. I thought it was really like enchanting. I thought all of the cast was good. I have a few particular favorites that were my favorite characters, but I really, really enjoyed it. The songs were catchy. I too felt like I needed to dance as soon as this was over. Like, I was doing fake tap dancing and like trying to get Jamie to laugh when we were done watching. I think I know exactly what you have a problem with. And I also was very taken out of it at that moment. And I think we'll get to it, assuming that we share the same sentiment, but it wasn't enough to ruin the experience. I thought this was a really fun, enjoyable movie.
It has a strange structure.
Yes.
Like, the movie starts with, it opens on a movie premiere in 1927. You're at Grauman's Chinese Theater, and all these movie stars are walking out who are these sort of approximations of, you know, like people who would have been actual stars or movie bigwigs at the time, like a send-up of Louis B. Mayer, Pola Negri, you know, sort of stand-ins. And then we meet our main character, Don, played by Gene Kelly. He gets invited up with his co-star, and he's being interviewed about their work and how he got through, how he made it to be a big star. And it jumps to a flashback as he's talking about dignity and just working hard and going to the best schools, aka like tap dancing at a bar and getting thrown out, going to the finest stage shows, and it's like sneaking into a King Kong send up.
I like that sequence a lot.
Yeah, I like that a lot, because too.
No one could fact check you back then. Like, there's no, yeah. No right. One's going through and being like, I don't see you on the Juilliard records or whatsoever. Like, this is outrageous. Where were you? So you could just say that kind of stuff and people would be like, wow, I mean, he's so good. I believe it. And you wouldn't think that you came from nothing dancing for pennies at a pool hall.
Exactly. And, you know, so many people like Joan Crawford, Cary Grant, like, had that actual vaudevillian background, so it's a nice touch of that. And I loved the sequence of him doing all of the stunts, too. He starts off as a stuntman. In particular, the motorcycle off the cliff.
Yeah, I wrote it like a stunt. It must have been a really clever edit because it just looked really like a body falling off of the bike. And I was like, oh my God.
Wasn't the body landing in the exact same spot in the water as the bike?
Oh, yeah, like right on the handlebars. I was like, ugh.
Yeah, the bike's not sinking that fast. Like, it'll hit and kind of just settle and then sink. And that dude just definitely hit the exact same spot. My favorite was when he walks into the barn and then the whole barn explodes. Like, yeah, that's not a stunt. That's just murder. You just murdered him. There's no safety net in there.
Yeah. Or just there's one, like, he just drives a plane into a building or something. Like, just outrageous.
I will say, like, before we get too far away, because I really, that's one of the highlights, I think, for me, is, like, right in the beginning where they kind of showcase the two of them kind of, they're not even singing, they're just doing choreography, I think. They're just, they're doing the dueling violins and everything, and maybe it's just because I just don't go to a lot of musicals or anything, but I was, like, really taken aback by, like, how impressive and calculated everything was, and how smooth it was, and there's not a bead of sweat on their heads, and it's was really, really impressive for me. And one of the most impressive parts of the movie is the choreography. I would almost even say more so than the singing.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, it's directed at least in part by Gene Kelly himself, who was an incredibly exacting perfectionist choreographer. And you see it in...
It's all in like one take. Like all of these like dance numbers are like impressively so. Some of the camera movements are wild. I mean, I don't think they were as extravagant as they were in the late 20s or 30s around that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was done in the 50s. But yeah, like really impressive long takes. And yeah, I just it's kind of incredible. I don't even know how many times they could have had to do it to really nail it, but they did.
Yep.
I love that whole violin sequence, especially when they're both playing each other's.
Yeah.
And moving in sync. And then when they're standing next to each other and they're both playing, and then all of a sudden Gene takes both like bows and is playing. And the other guy's just like, oh, where'd my bow go? Oh, and then he starts like playing it like a little like guitar.
Yeah, like Cosmo's like on top of his back and it's made to look like a giant playing. So it was a weird combination of limbs and violins. And I was like, I'm really impressed right now.
Well, and that was the thing too, because like right as soon as they're done and he's talking about like, and we played to the adulation of the crowd and they start booing him. And I'm like, listen, I don't care if this is not your cup of tea. Like, I do not care who you came here to see. I don't care what comedian or what, you know, lounge singer, elegant woman in a cocktail dress you came to see. That shit is impressive. You have no right booing those two men. That was the most impressive thing I've ever seen on stage.
Or it made me think, what did they see that was even more impressive than that? Because I want to see that.
If they get booed, I want to see what you're cheering. Because
Bravo.
Yeah. So then we move into the premiere of the new Lena Lamont and Don, what's his last name
Lockwood.
In the movie? Lockwood. Don Lockwood movie.
Lockwood Lamont
film. It's a silent film, romantic. And there's another good line that made me guffaw out loud, where there's this young woman sitting in the audience and she's clearly moved by Lena in particular. And she says, she's so refined. I think I'll kill myself.
Oh, yes. That was great.
The desperation in 1927 that if you're at the premiere of a movie in Hollywood and someone is so much more refined that you just want to end the whole thing.
She's so refined. I think I'll kill myself. It's just... God. Yeah. And then the starring couple comes out, they take their bow, he gives all the thank you speeches, as you realize when they shift back behind stage and she opens her mouth that she sounds terrible.
She sounds abysmal. Yeah, the whole movie it's rough.
Yeah. And good on the performer, I forget her name. She was nominated for an Oscar for this role, but oh my God, rough.
Yeah, so rough. Shrill, so high pitched.
I will say though, like right that premiere when they leave the premiere and he's trying to get a ride or whatever, and he's yelling to Cosmo to call me a cab, and he goes, "You're a cab."
Cosmo's great. He's one of my favorites.
He's so good. He's probably my favorite character in the movie.
Yeah.
So in the moment where he's giving all the thank yous and Lena's not getting her word in edgewise, I was feeling bad for her in that moment. I was like, you know, these men in the 30s or the 20s, they just can't give the women their due. You got to let her talk. And then when I realized why, I was like, oh, wait, that was genius. And as the movie goes on, I feel less and less bad for this woman. But in that very first moment, I was like, come on, man, let the woman talk. Come on. She has opinions. Oh, yeah. She has things to say. And then immediately it was like, oh, no, shut her up.
She's like, quiet. No.
They go to a Hollywood after party, I believe, is the next.
Yeah. Well, they're on their way.
We have to get from the mob.
Yeah.
He falls into Debbie Reynolds' car. Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't fall in.
He jumps in.
He jumps on top of a moving, like, trolley car, and he then jumps in. And he Jackie Chan's into her car, lands. She freaks out. She's like, I know your face. You're a criminal.
I saw you on a poster at the post office. The numbers underneath.
And pull over to see a police officer. And that's when she realizes who he is. She offers to drive him to Beverly Hills and drop him off at his house. He's trying to put the moves on her, and she puts a stop to it by saying she doesn't really like movies. If you've seen one, you've seen them all. Mm-hmm. And his pride is very wounded. But that sequence I really liked. I thought it was a great movie meet cute. I thought they had a good rapport. And they're both equally charming in the different moments that, like, they take turns being on the back foot, but each of them is giving as good as they get. Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the after party.
Well, before we get away from that, I want to get your guys' opinion on her assessment about movies of this time period. Do you consider silent movie stars acting, or are they just simply performance artists with their faces? Like, would you consider them, given everything that acting is now, would you consider people of that time period actors? Do you agree with her position?
Well, I would say back then, I don't think the focus, even though it should have been the focus, that, like, you really got to think really about, like, the physical attributes of what you're doing acting-wise. I think they really were just acting, and then just they would just do the text or whatever. They didn't really give credence to the fact that they really had to think about what they look with their faces and everything. And it's funny you bring that up, because I totally forgot about the movie The Artist that came out like a decade ago, which was all about this, really. And the guy that I think two people in the movie walked away with awards. And yeah, I'm not really trying to make an example out of that, even though it's like the perfect example that, yeah, you don't need to say anything to be a really good actor. But I think back then they didn't really think about it in terms of that, because it was just, like I said, they acted like they did on soundstage. They spoke and everything. They didn't, like, not talk. Mm-hmm. And then they would just do the title card, the closed caption card over it. So my answer is yes. But I think in that moment, I think she has a case for why they are stripped or robbed of a certain part of the acting that is not getting through on the screen.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially considering like stage performers of the time would have been doing all of the same physical acting, but also reciting lines and putting emotion in their voice and things like that, that we now think of today as traditional acting.
Yeah. And I honestly didn't even know this movie was going to be one about, like, appear into sort of like Hollywood air back then. I know, Bridget, you talked a little bit beforehand about that maybe being the case, but the fact that it was going to be during that transitional stage of the advent of talkies and talking movies. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, I'm really going to enjoy this. This is going to be good. So I like that conversation a lot, because she had a lot of good points. It's like, you are only doing a third of what I usually do up there, or two thirds of what I do in front of, like, a live audience.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something to, I still think of silent films as films, you know, there's a variety of quality for sure, but sort of thinking about this in terms of thinking about, you know, I wouldn't say that maybe Debbie Reynolds is a great actress, but she's a great performer. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because I was comparing her in my mind to Elizabeth Taylor for the obvious reasons. And I was like, you know, Elizabeth Taylor could not dance like that. But Elizabeth Taylor is still a great actress. Mm-hmm. Debbie Reynolds, you know, you couldn't put her necessarily, I don't think, maybe she could do it, like in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof or Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. But she's still a great performer. And so I think it's a, you have people who can do both, but they're different skills, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, here, like, everything's shot so wide, it's like they're really focused on what they can do physically with their whole body, mm-hmm. opposed to what they can do with, say, like, their eyes when you have, like, ultra wide close-up shots and everything where people, the eyes can just speak. You can barely, you could see, I guess, suppose see some of that, but, I mean, for us, we see it because it's, you know, a high-definition movie, you know, upscaled from a 52 print or whatever. Mm-hmm. Back then, you got to think about the resolution of what they had. Everything had to be shot, like, super wide. It's an interesting question. I just don't know. I would think back then their focus would be more on the dancing and getting your in the singing than really just – or not even the singing. I'm sorry because we're getting away from the silent part of it. But that it was really just more physical, like, body attributes than anything else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, like, it, when you think of, like, stars of the time, like, of the silent era – Clara Bow, Greta Garbo, who eventually, like, transitions, but they're these actors with these really big features on their faces, too. So they're just, like, mm-hmm. really interesting to look at. Theda Bara, just, like, I need to, I can't take my eyes off you,
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah, but I think all three leads have, like, this crazy, like, old world Hollywood face that just, mm-hmm. like, just can't, like, shake. Like, they just... Like, all their eyes are sparkling, and, like, they just – all of them have, like, rougy faces, and it's just, like, ugh. And Debbie Reynolds is just, like, endlessly charming. It's just, like, immediately you just fall in love with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Gene Kelly looks like he was created by an algorithm. Like, his face I know, really. Is so, like, symmetrical and square.
He's got a Hollywood jawline.
Mm-hmm. He does.
And then Donald O'Connor just has, like, the goofy look, but, like, it's perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, man. The scenes where he's, like, manipulating his face.
Oh, that was good stuff.
And I'm
yeah.
just like, how? How do you do this?
He has, like, a really – we'll get to it, but he has a really good, like, solo number where he's dancing around the studio. Like, mm-hmm. I love that scene, too, because it's so physical and – he's landing what is probably just, like, cement soundstage. Mm-hmm. I'm like, God, man, you got to – it's got a heart, but I love getting back to a really lovely scene, the two of them setting both of them up, really charming, and you could tell immediately that they're just gonna have a trouble falling in love with all the things that are around them.
Yeah.
I know, I was so glad when she showed up too, because I was not enjoying Lena at all, and so yeah. The second that Debbie Reynolds shows up, that Kathy comes in, I was like, okay, good. We're with these two now. This is going to be the focus of the movie. I'm so happy because, like, look how adorable they are. Look at their band. Like, listen to their banter. It's amazing. And, okay, we could go from here. And hopefully we leave Lena by the wayside because these are the stars.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So we get to the after party, which, of course, you have to have a movie at because it can't be a Hollywood party without a movie. What did you guys think of the introduction of the talkie?
It was like being over at my apartment like 10 years ago. If you're staying over, you're watching a movie.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how long you wanted to come here for. You're sitting through whatever length this movie is.
Yeah, well, yeah, whatever. Yeah,
I did enjoy the like the introduction and all the dismissals of the talkie. Be like, there's a man behind the screen. Hey, man behind the screen, come out from behind there. And the guy is standing by them like, I'm right here. It's a record on wax.
And I liked how strange the, like, test film was too. Just mm-hmm. someone like, this is
yeah, probably the only close up shot in the whole movie, and he's, like, moving his jaw to, like, articulate. Like, can you hear the words that I am saying? It's like,
yeah. It almost felt kind of David Lynch-y. I was like, I don't know. Ugh. I'm uncomfortable right now.
Everyone in the audience seemed to be uncomfortable.
Yeah. This will never take off.
Yeah.
The jazz singer? Like.
I like the real world implication, though, that they weren't just like, other fake movie studio is making a movie that's all about, you know, whatever, and like trying to skirt that the jazz singer isn't real in this universe. Like, I liked the grounded nature of like, no, the Warners are doing it. They've got the jazz singer. Like, these are real world studios we've heard of, though. Is Monumental Pictures? I don't think that one's real, is it?
I think Monumental Pictures is meant to be MGM, because like at the time you would have had MGM. You would have had Warner Brothers, RKO. I'm not sure. Universal, I think, was called something else at the time. Like, it eventually merged, and
I'm not sure. I don't know if Paramount is around then.
Paramount comes later, I think.
Yeah. But, I mean, back then there was really only just like enough you can count on your own hand, but.
Mm-hmm. And then smaller studios that like it, some of it is just like lost media, like it, because none of it was ever saved or archived. I love the plot device of how are we going to make this transition from silent films to like movies with sound. I think it's so fun, and it lets you have so many fun scenes as they're trying to figure out this new technology and get around it. And how are we going to deal with a problem like Lena kind of thing?
No, and it absolutely, for, I think even for, you know, for us at the very least, it puts an absolute, you know, stamp that this is exactly where we are in the timeline of all this, where maybe you would maybe get lost a little bit. Okay, where are we at? Like, I don't know, like using that. Not using, I want to say a crux, but it's a good way to sort of let you know that exactly where we are.
Yeah, it's like a linchpin that gives you an exact, like, so you say you miss the 1927 premiere at the beginning, you may not necessarily know what era it takes place in, because I don't think they say it until later. So having the jazz singer in there at least gives you some kind of reference of like, oh, okay, this isn't 1950. Assuming you're seeing it when it first came out, you're like, oh, this isn't now. This is 30 years ago or 20 years ago or whatever. So I did enjoy that. We then get the debut of Debbie's Rockette character. Comes dancing out of the cake, which I laughed really hard at that, especially when they immediately lock eyes and she's just like, damn it. I gave him all this shit about being a silent actor and me being this glorified actor of stage. And here I am popping out of a cake at someone else's movie premiere party.
And that was like the first number in the movie. And we're like half an hour in.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, are we only going to have like a couple of these? And then like it was a full on assault like the next like
it ramps
90
up
minutes or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's a short one, like just enough. To give
Listen,
you some flavor
I
and see
I
what
like
she's
the short
capable
ones
of.
In this movie. I like the short ones in this movie. Because there's really like just short ones, and there's one really long one.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait to talk about it. And she pies Lena in the face.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Trying to hit him.
That was a good windup. I loved her like rear back and then just really slam it home. And I love the line when she's doing it of like, I'll show you what I learned from the movies, which is just implying that everyone was getting a pie in the face in the movies back then.
Yeah. Again, a great bit of film trivia. Yeah. A lot of pies. He chases after her into the women's dressing room. She disappears into the night and he is still smitten with her.
Oh, yeah.
We jump to 3 weeks later. And he's still moping.
And this is where we get the number Johnny was talking about with what's his name? Don O'Connor. Cosmo. I'm trying to remember the character's name. With Cosmo, where he does make him laugh.
Yeah, the make him laugh one, yeah.
Yep. Which that one is just a masterclass in physical comedy.
It's crazy.
You know, he's doing the flips on all the things, and then at one point he goes through the wall because he's trying to flip. He's you know, going over chairs. He's walking on planks. That couch gets
flipped over every which way.
Yeah. He's walking on planks. He's walking under planks. He's getting hit in the back of the head by a board. Like, it's every
vaudeville routine. There's a dummy at one point that he's dancing with and throwing around.
That one's great. I love, because when they, like, he puts his arm around her and the dummy's arm goes onto his leg and he throws it off and it comes back. Like, everything about that was really, really good. He was very impressive and honestly one of my favorite characters. I mean, the leads are great, but as far as side characters go, it's him and it's RF. I loved all of RF's lines. Yeah.
That sequence is probably where I like really started liking the movie. Like, I enjoyed elements of it going into it, and like right around then, I'm like, okay, I'm like kind of really enjoying this right now.
Mm-hmm.
That make 'em laugh sequence. The actor Donald O'Connor apparently was smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day.
Good Lord.
And this is from IMDb. He ended up in a hospital bed for a week after its completion. He suffered from exhaustion and painful carpet burns. Unfortunately, an accident ruined all of the initial footage. So after a brief rest, O'Connor agreed to do the difficult number all over again.
No.
Mm-hmm.
So he did all of Make 'em Laugh, and then none of it was usable, and he had to do the whole thing again?
Yep.
Jeez.
Yikes. While smoking 4 packs a day.
I mean, I think you would have to.
4 unfiltered packs a day.
Push yourself through that kind of...
I mean, the lung stamina alone must have been compromised beyond all recognition.
I know.
Like, every time they show you a picture of a diseased lung, that's probably his, and he probably did that whole movie while having that lung, which is just it's a very super impressive thing. Is that why his face kept twitching? Because he was jonesing for another one?
Yeah, he's like, just put something right in the corner of my mouth. You got it. Just throw it in there like a dart.
Yeah. Right in there and give me a light.
Like,
that was probably one of my favorites in terms of the performances, like the songs. And it was one I feel like I've heard before. I don't know if I've, you know, we talked about it at the beginning, only really knowing Singing in the Rain and the first few lines of it, because that's what permeate. But for some reason, I feel like I've heard Make 'em Laugh before in something else, even if it was just like a little snippet. But I'd never seen anything regarding the choreography for that, which was, as I said, incredibly impressive. So at this point, the movie they were trying to make, which is called The Dueling Cavalier, is now being transitioned into a talkie. So the studio has come in and said the jazz singer was a huge hit, a huge success. Nobody believed RF, but he knew it right from the get-go. So we're taking this movie and we're transitioning it completely into a talkie. And the process of making this and getting to the first screening of it was some of the funniest moments, at least for me, of this movie, which I'm like you, Bridget, I laughed way more than I thought I was going to at this. This was a really funny movie that I was anticipating, you know, it's going to have the sappy love story. It's going to have the song. It's going to have the dance. It's going to have those kind of elements. At no point at any time in this discussion beforehand did I think we were going to laugh as much as I laughed during this movie. So that was a pleasant surprise. And most of that came here. What were some of your favorite moments of transforming the Dueling Cavalier into a talkie?
Well, I don't want to take Johnny's thunder from the emoji, but that is a highlight. And just the sequence of them trying to figure out the sounds of, like, talking to the bush, just talking to the bush, and placing the mic in different places and trying to figure out how we're going to get the sound.
Which is still like a problem today. Like, it's very much something like, just for example, if you ever watch like a talk show, like the mic is always placed on the shoulder or the lapel that is facing the person you're interviewing. So like, if you ever like turn your head, you would get that same thing. Like, mics are still, we've come a very long way with mics. We made them very small, but it's still the same thing. Like, if you turn your head and move your away, it's going to cut in and out.
Yeah.
So it's problems that, you know, professionally people still deal with today. But yes, Bridget, that is probably the funniest sequence in the movie for me.
It also reminded me of recording this show.
Yes.
And various problems and difficulties that we've had.
Yeah. I said that watching the movie, I was like, this is the director who looks like he's about to have an aneurysm every single time he has to walk in and out of that soundproof booth. I was like, this is me every time like I had to introduce someone new to being on a podcast that never like the, you know, there was one point where I had to argue with people on the show about whether or not we could have cookies during the show. And I'm like, no, we can't. It's going to pick up all of the sounds. And if you try to turn away, then we're just going to hear you chewing when you come back towards the microphone. We cannot do this. So I felt that in that moment.
Yeah. And there's a little bit in the lead up to the transition.
I was going to say, I think I'm looking down and I have at least three numbers I think we missed since. So there's like a beautiful girl, which is kind of just like a quick one with all the costumes and everything, which I think is like
outrageous,
which is outrageous. But I also think it's like a red herring for all the craziness that we see in that big number at the end where there's all these costume changes. Mm-hmm. There is one. I'm just going off of what I think is like the words that are used the most in the song. They could be called something else, but one is "I'm content," I think, which is just Donald and Kathy just on an empty soundstage where he's kind of turning on the sunrise or whatever, the fan or whatever. But that was a great number right there. That was really good.
You were meant for
me. So romantic.
Yeah, you were meant for me. Yeah, it was really good. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
That was really good. The setup for it was great too. Of the "I can't tell you here, I have to tell you in the perfect moment," and then going through and like turning on one light, turning on the fan, turning on the spotlights, turning on the background lights, and the way that Debbie Reynolds' face is lit up from the front and the back when he's like, "Now it's going to be brighter than all the stars in the sky," and like all of the lights behind her are there. Like that one shot was just like,
yeah, a like perfect shows, it really Hollywood shows the naive person watching it that there's a lot of elements that go into making someone look good. Mm-hmm. With wind and other things. So I thought that was kind of cool. So great number there. And then there's like a funny moment in between the next number where we meet the whole diction coach shit. Mm-hmm. That stuff was really funny. You can tell that right away that she's not going to succeed in any way whatsoever. And then we get a really funny one with Donald and Cosmo with a diction coach. Mm-hmm. And I could only surmise that the name of this song is called Moses Toeses.
It's called Moses. Yeah.
Oh, it is called Moses. Okay. Yeah. I thought that was a fun little number. Again, highlighting the two of them. Cosmo killed it in his solo thing, but it's best when at least one or two of them, and when all three of them are on screen, it's absolutely like, it's fire. But yeah, like I think the number ends with them throwing trash on the diction coach or whatever. I thought that was pretty funny.
Like stacking chairs and the sign that has like vowel A.
A, yeah.
Yeah.
And it
ends.
A. Yeah.
You don't know what happens to the diction coach.
He's just
the one thing you feel bad about. It's where he lives now.
He becomes a part of the space, the office space.
Yeah.
And then I think right there and then we sort of arrive at all the microphone shenanigans that happen with the bush and the heartbeat coming through her chest. I mean, that's outrageous. That is complete exaggeration, but it's hilarious.
Well, I mean, do you see the size of the microphone they put in there? I don't know
it's pretty big, but I don't know if it would be that sensitive.
Get these wires out of here.
That was great. And when she flips over the back of the bench when he yanks the lock, like, this is unsafe.
Yeah.
I will say, having not seen this movie, I've seen that scene somewhere before. I don't know where it would have lived or if it went like a, you know, some sort of, I know we talk about seeing reels in award seasons or what have you, or I've definitely seen that sort of gag before about, you know, talking into the bush. So I thought I was like, oh yeah, this is funny. And I have seen this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was pretty good. And then we get the actual premiere of the movie, which I thought that was like the full on movie premiere and not just a screening. And I'm sitting there going, who let this get this far? How did you watch any of this in the editing bay or whatever it is you did for movies back then and not go, what the fuck are we doing?
You know, I think you're right. I'm surprised you even got as far as the preview night. It's just wild. But because it's not even like a test screening for like people who worked on the movie. It's like actual people who have not seen a second of it.
Yeah. Well, and they're all dressed up in suits. So this isn't like some weird, you know, focus group where everyone's just there in a you know, in a conference room watching the movie. Like, they went to the movies. Like, they are dressed to the nines and they're out for a night at the cinema, and they got to watch pearl clutching the movie, where it's just...
Oh, the beads.
Oh yeah, the pearls is constantly. It didn't even sound like pearls too. They did some sort of ridiculous folly for it that just sounded so hilarious.
The beads, and then when he throws his cane and you hear it clatter for 5 seconds off screen.
Or like his pants like moving together.
Yeah.
When he's walking down the stairs. And then obviously the sound out of sync was just like so good.
Oh, especially when it slows down.
Yes.
When it slows down, it's like, no, yes. So I was dying laughing. I was right there with the audience members, just completely like doubled over in my seat. so funny, ridiculous. But yeah, it's like, and then they're all embarrassed standing outside the theater, and they're like, "That's it, we're done." And it's like, how did nobody see this and go, "It's not right. We got to do the whole thing again."
Well, Alina liked it.
Well, yeah, because she doesn't know.
She's an idiot.
Yeah.
We've established everyone in the movie and everyone watching thinks she's dumb. But yeah, that was absolutely ridiculous. So I think at this point we get the big,
the three of them together at the house.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Good morning. Yeah.
That's a song I've definitely heard before.
Yeah.
Same. When that started, I was like, oh, okay, I've heard this one. But yeah, they were having their midnight snack of some kind of sandwich nobody ate and a glass of milk. And then they sing Good Morning. And I think this one is my favorite song and dance number. The song is catchy. And the choreography here is great. The ending where they come over the couch and then sit on it, where it still looks like they're sitting on a normal couch, but it's flipped upside down. This, I think, was my favorite sequence where they're figuring out that they could turn the whole thing into a musical.
By the way, I don't think I've seen anyone so cheery at 2 o'clock in the morning, whatever it was, coming up with a number like that.
Yeah.
At least the people that I spend my time with are spent at that point.
I don't know. I feel like I've seen a dance party or two at 1:30 in the morning. You know, I feel like I've seen people riled up enough to get a little dancey. Not that well.
Yeah, certainly not welcoming the next day. They're kind of holding on to the day before, but nonetheless.
Not in sync, you know, they're not at all together.
Not excited for the milkman to be on his way.
Well, that's why they were having that glass of milk.
They're like, he'll be here soon.
We got to finish this. We got to finish this bottle before the milkman comes again in the morning.
That's a highlight of the movie, both in terms of the singing, the choreography, the chemistry between all three leads is really good. You really get a sense that these are like people who like each other and have fun and are friends.
Almost a little too much, so I'm not sure. Like the three of them are pretty close. I'm not coming up with any conspiracies here, but it's like.
No, you're right, though, because there's. Like when they're finished and they're all like panting on the couch, Debbie is both obviously leaning in to Don, but then she's also just like casually just like brushing her head against Cosmo,
and they
just
both get decent kisses afterwards too, I think, mm-hmm. or right before.
Yeah, he gets a peck on the cheek for coming up with the idea.
But the raincoats make an appearance before, and by the way, the raincoats are just there, and then no one ever uses them the rest of the movie.
Yep.
Yeah, they're there at the beginning.
At least outside.
Yeah.
Just something I was reading, though, about that sequence. It was really difficult. They spent so much time that Debbie Reynolds, like, was really trying to do all of the tap moves. She was only 19 when she made this movie, and she had no dance background prior.
That's outrageous.
Yep. She burst blood vessels in the soles of her feet from how hard she was dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And and Gene Kelly was a perfectionist. Apparently he was very, very hard on her to the point that she would, you know, cry. At one point she went and cried in another studio under a piano, and Fred Astaire came and found her and was like, "It's going to be okay." But Gene Kelly, in retrospect, said I was way too hard on her. But at the time, he was getting so sick of, like, I can't keep yelling at her because all of her crying keeps holding up production. So anytime he wanted to yell about something, he would just yell at Donald O'Connor instead. Like, he can take it. I'll just yell at him about all of the things I want to yell at her about. So they made it look much more fun than it probably was to be in that room.
Yeah. Did he try constructive criticism? Or was it all just blood-curdling screams?
He's so smiley, too. Can you imagine that face yelling at you, that symmetrical square face?
Kind of. Terrifying. He's also, like, not a small dude. Like, he's got big arms. He would be very intimidating, I think, if he was yelling at you.
Yeah.
Like, I can see it. Especially if you're some fresh-faced 19-year-old who's learning dance for the first time, and this dude comes in flailing his arms and legs in perfect synchronicity with the other guy.
Just it's a kickball change, god damn it!
Yeah.
Come off a turnip truck, god.
Back in my day, I would have killed for Tappa Tappa Tappa.
So they have their genius idea, the three of them, and he takes her home and kisses her goodnight. It's this sweet romantic moment between the two of them. And at that point, he waves the cab on after she's gone inside and decides to walk home and sing and dance in the rain. And we get our title performance, which I think because I've seen bits and pieces of it, I found underwhelming.
Yeah. It pales in comparison to a number of sequences in this movie for me.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's iconic because it's the name of the movie. It's the titular song. Some of the effects when he's like tapping in puddles, like with the water splashing and stuff, like that looks cool. It's very stylized. I love the cop walking over and being like, "Are you an insane man?" Just with his face. Like, he just looks at him like, "Are you high on drugs? Are you a dope fiend? Like, what are you doing slapping about puddles with your legs? Not using your umbrella. It's a torrential downpour. Should I lock you up?" I loved that whole little sequence. But you're right. So many more musical numbers in this movie are more impressive than this one.
Yeah, for me, at the end of this movie, I just tried to wrap my head around the relevance of why they picked that number to be the one, the title of the movie, why it was so significant. I mean, you can go deep about him being just like on the moon, happy about where he's in his life, no matter what, because it's raining and it's dark and they're going through all this trouble with trying to make a movie that it just, it's cathartic or however you want to look at it. But I just think that it's just for the title number, it's underwhelming, it's short, it's just him, and the set is, you know, cool as it is, just raining, it's just not nearly as impressive to the eye as some of the other movements and the camera flying around or whatever
as Broadway rhythm.
Well, yeah, and too, like, to your point about the set, like, it's just a backlot street. Like, it's just the same street that you see in a million other things.
Yeah.
It's every single, like, Warner Brothers lot, picture, back street, whatever. So it doesn't stand out as being overly impressive. Not that the indoor sets are, other than the one we're about to get to. But it's, like, you're right. It's the title sequence of the movie, why that one versus something else. Like, I guess you couldn't really call the movie "You Were Meant for Me" or "Make 'Em Laugh" or anything, but it is weird that that one was the one that was picked, even though it's further down the list of the more impressive.
And I know it did sort of like come back at the end where it's like on a billboard or what have you. I just thought it would have been a little more interesting for them to like leave the premiere and it's raining and they kiss under the rain or some sort of comeback to this whole thing. And it was kind of just a throwaway at the end, like, oh, we got to just do one more title drop and just make it a little more relevant. So, again, good number, catchy, iconic, just not in the scheme of the whole movie. There's just so many. It's dwarfed with everything else.
All right, so we've touched on it a handful of times here. This is the part where I got completely lost as to what was going on.
He goes to the studio head and explains what the plan is going to be. And we see little of they're going to dub over Lena with Kathy's voice. And we see some of that process and her singing. And now the way you lead into this sequence is, how are we going to bring in modern dance into this movie? And the framework of it is a guy who's trying out for Broadway gets hit in the head and has this wild, fantastical dream.
That was a good idea for, like, weaving. Like, that's a really actually genius idea to turn a movie that you filmed that you can't reshoot 100, because they would have had to reshoot the entire movie in order to make it work as a musical, not just a couple of sequences here and there. And they only had 6 weeks. So mixing in a modern tale and a dream sequence is actually a really genius way to do it. But the way in which we get to the sequence was actually one of my favorite shots in the movie, where it pans into him and then like pans, it like zooms in on him and then pans over as he's like, and then we go and we enter on Broadway. And like it follows his hand along as it cut, like as it zooms over to the screen. I love that shot. I thought that was really, really impressive. But then the Broadway's Gotta Have It number or whatever.
Broadway rhythm.
I was so lost as to what was going on. I was like, wait, where are we? Where would this even fit? I was trying to figure out, like, where does it even fit in the context of the movie we are now calling Dancing Cavalier, as it's been turned into a musical. But, Johnny, I assume this is the sequence you were talking about.
Yeah, I at some point during this, yeah, I was reaching, like, Death to Smoochie levels of delirium watching the sequence. Like, I just I was shaking, like, my cup of water was empty because I was like dehydrated from watching it. There's a number of question marks next to the phrase "why so long" in my notes.
Yeah,
and I continue to write another question mark with every passing minute. I just, individual parts of it were impressive. They were, I will say that, but it was just so long, and I'm like, where are we going with this? And what really like stuck, like really like a knife in my heart, is when it ended and he goes, so that's what we want to do with it.
Oh, no,
it wasn't even filmed or like anything. Like it was just like he was telling him the idea. And I'm like, oh my God.
But I love he follows up with, I can't really picture it. Yeah, I'll have to see it filmed.
God.
I love everything bookending the sequence.
Right.
Like the sequences, and to be fair though, I do love his like aw shucks nerdy outfit as he gets to Broadway for the very first time. Like he's got the suspenders or the vest, he's got the glasses, he's got
everything, yeah.
The pink tie, like, and then they rip it off, and I just like him going to all the agents and like that whole part. I really like that. If it had just been that bit, it would have been fine. But then we got into this weird story about him going to a nightclub that has some kind of mafia boss who flips coins. And his girlfriend dances there, and then his security guards also flip coins.
I thought it was girl flips coins. Or something. I
loved that. As soon as the hat lands on her shoe, and then she lifts her fucking leg behind her head, I was like, "I'm all in. Say less. Keep more of this forever."
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I loved.
And again, I'm a little
but
like.
But I can see how it would be challenging. That was the point that Brian came in after he came back from the gym, and he was like, "Why did you make them watch this? What? What have you done?"
He does have a heart. but my thought was, since again I haven't seen a lot of musicals, that, oh, maybe there's like this one big like number that they always do. And some of these where it was just at least some of the older musicals where all the other ones are small and peppered. And then you have this one big grand number, and then it kind of goes back to maybe a couple more, and then like the play ends. So again, I just didn't know if that was part of the norm. I'm going to go with that. It's not.
And it's not even that it's necessarily overly long. It's just so vastly different than every other sequence in the movie because it's meant to be a dream sequence, or I guess technically this is not the dream sequence.
It's a pitch.
This is the modern day
it's
part.
It's an 18-minute pitch. I didn't even look at the time, but I was scared to, but it was long. But yeah, it was, and then like I said, the fact that it was like, it was just him talking about what it could be, I was like, oh my God, they could have like chopped this up, but it would have hurt Bridget's feelings, so.
It would have hurt my feelings. Well, because I'm glad the good part about it being the pitch is you get to see the whole sequence in like full Technicolor. You get to see the whole thing without it. Otherwise, you would see the version that was black and white and edited for the film. And, you know, now you get
Cerise. Yeah, I mean, you're right. And it compared to the other numbers in this, like all the other numbers are these one takes. They're not edited or if they are, they're cleverly edited. Mm-hmm. And here it's like if you were to do like a montage or something, it would have looked weird and it would have pissed off Gene Kelly because all the work that probably put into the whole thing mm-hmm. would have been chopped the bits in the editing room. So I kind of understand why they kept it. I just understanding a little bit before they even shoot it, like why they decided to make something so big and long compared to all the other numbers in the movie.
Yeah.
Still very impressive. The whole
it's impressive nonetheless. But yeah, just
the whole sequence with the not ribbon, but like the big long train of her. Yeah. Oh, that was crazy.
Enormous stage.
Okay. Yeah, that was the one part where I was like, they must have taken. I don't know how many takes they probably would have done to get that right, because that's got to be a pain to just have that thing just slide off right at the wrong moment and have to do it again.
Wait a minute. Here I have something that I would like to share with you both from the IMDb trivia page about that particular sequence and the number of takes it would have taken. Filming of the Crazy Veil section of the Broadway ballet had to be stopped for several hours after it was discovered that Sid Charisse's pubic hair was visible through her costume. When the problem was finally fixed, the film's costume designer, Walter Plunkett, apparently said, "It's okay, guys. We finally got Sid's crotch licked."
That's the verbiage he used?
According to IMDb.
According to lore. I thought it was going to be something along the lines of, like, damn it, Gene, it was supposed to be Lena who was performing to the bush.
Yeah. It does make me wonder, like, what was the sequence in which they were shot? Is that why the bush joke got put in? But...
was that even a colloquialism back then for them to have that? Like, or is this just a whole nother layer too? So
that's great.
Is there anything else then that we want to say about the overly long Broadway sequence?
I just want to go to bat for it again and say it's really astounding. And even if you watch it entirely divorced from Singing in the Rain, it's captivating. Mm. So I would encourage listeners who maybe are afraid of musicals, don't want to go down that road, to check it out, because it's a spectacle.
I honestly think I would have liked it better outside of the context mm-hmm. of watching it within this movie, because again, it was so vastly different than anything that we saw throughout the rest of the movie. And I was trying through most of it to figure out where this would even go in the new fake movie, that it didn't make any sense. Because I'm like, okay, well, when are we going to get to the part where we cut to him getting hit on the head with a brick? And then we go into the weird old French section. Like, when do we get to that part? That's the mm-hmm. part where I was. So the whole time, just like, seriously, this is still going. And also, where in the movie is this going to go? It doesn't make any sense. Trying to edit on the fly here, but I did enjoy the bookends of saying I can't picture it.
And funny enough, because I mean, correct me, but it didn't even seem like Cosmo or not Lena.
Kathy
were even in that number.
Well, no, they wouldn't have been in the movie. So it would have only the person who could have shown up was Lena. Like, I thought maybe Lena would have been like a waitress at the club or something in that moment to tie it all together kind of thing. But I guess he just dreams of, you know, himself. Random person or something like that. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I, you know, normally when there's a dream sequence in a movie, the characters that they know from real life are playing the main roles.
Yeah.
So I would have thought that Lena would have at least showed up as like a, you know, one of the cabaret dancers or whatever. And that wasn't the case. All right, so then after this whole thing wraps up, I think it pretty quickly goes to the screening of the new movie. Do they do anything else to it beforehand, or do we then get the premiere of the new movie?
The only thing that I can think of is, like, right afterwards, it jumps to, I believe, the dubbing sequence. So even before we get to the movie screening itself.
We get to Lena finding out.
Correct.
That's right. We get to Lena finding out. So they've said she can't know about this. We're going to, you know, we're going to make Debbie Reynolds a huge, huge star, but don't let Lena find out. And of course, at the final dubbing session, Rita Moreno comes in and spills the beans. Lets everybody know, specifically Lena, that in fact, Lena's voice will not be used for any of this. And we get her weird, evil, take back the night kind of revenge piece to make sure that she is the only star of this picture. What did you guys think about this, her PR stunt and this kind of reveal that she's no longer the star?
Yeah, I mean, it made my blood boil. It made me hate her even more. But she did a very good job of doing that. But yeah, it was funny that she sort of had like an argument or something set up, like my lawyer and this and that. And I was like, she's got some shit put together, at least in her life.
There's something particularly funny about a woman with that voice who's been playing a ditz the whole time, all of a sudden quoting a lawyer and being like, Article 2, Section Section A says that I'm allowed to sue you.
This is an affidavit.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fun inverse of probably what really would have happened, like if a woman went into real life Louis B. Mayer's office and was like, I'm going to do this. He would have just like sicked Eddie Mannix on them. But
some of the coin flippers would have come back and taken her out of there.
Yeah, he would have flipped a coin menacingly at her. but it makes your blood boil, but you also know there can't be too much left of the movie. We just had ballet on Broadway.
There's no surprises left on the table whatsoever for me. Like, I even knew that, like, okay, that I knew how it was going to be revealed in front of everyone that she was a false and that they were going to do something with her, like, oh, go ahead, Lena, sing for us, do a number for us. And I'm like, I knew that was going to happen. There's got to be some grand way of exposing her for just having just the most incredibly terrible voice.
Which, to be fair, that whole part and the whole like grand plan, like as evil as she seems in this moment, it is kind of rude to cut her out essentially and not. She never would have gone along with making the movie work with someone else other than herself. Like, I don't think she ever would have taken the, you know, the criticism of your voice just isn't made for talking pictures. I'm sorry. We'll do the best that we can. We'll make it so that way you're not embarrassed here. Like, she never would have gone along with that, but the whole doing it behind her back and kind of cutting her out and then embarrassing her like that, which she kind of asked for, was a little bit mean. So I did.
But
kind
I mean,
of
like, she was about to like ruin Kathy's life or whatever with the whole, like, you know, stripping of her credit and all that other stuff. So it was kind of just like a.
Correct. She had
it was a bad situation all around.
Yeah. No one comes out of here really smelling like a rose other than probably Kathy, because she was just the willing participant, but it was never her idea to make, you know. But then again, Lena Costa, her original job as the dancing cake girl. So,
yeah,
you know, nobody comes out here exactly smelling like a rose. But
I did like how like the three of them like sort of just started singing and they kind of danced around and then went to like the rope and just pulled it up.
Oh, and like, like just so joyfully.
Very jovial.
My favorite part of that was the orchestra knew the song Singing in the Rain.
Oh yeah, just what key it is. Yeah, A flat. Okay, we got it, boys. Let's do it.
Yeah. Oh, we're doing Singing in the Rain, A flat. Okay, got it.
And the fact that she even knew it too. Like, how the hell would she have known that song?
Yeah, I don't know.
Whatever. The movies.
I will say that the clip that we saw of Dancing Cavalier is a much better clip than what we saw of Dueling Cavalier. So it was a really good idea to turn it into a musical. It was became a much better movie. Actually watchable.
Yes.
Do you guys think that Kathy forgave Don a little too quickly, or was she right in that he actually did go to bat for her and saved her? Because she breaks up with him. Like, she says, I don't ever want to see you again. I'm doing this one last song. I'm helping her through this, and then I'm out of here. And then he goes to bat for her and says, no, she's the girl. She's the star. Do you guys think that was a satisfying ending of them coming back and embracing? Or did you want to see her maybe ride it out a little bit? Or give him one last ribbing?
It worked for me. At that point, I knew it was sort of the end of the movie. And then I was sort of setting myself up for like, okay, it's got to be fairly quick tie up here. and they're not just going to have her just go separate ways. So I kind of knew that it was going to be like, everyone, no, this was her the entire time. It's her with the beautiful voice. So I just knew that that would have been enough for her to kind of be like, this guy's really fighting for me in my corner and he loves me. And so it worked for me.
Yeah. There maybe could have been a little bit more rather than just Debbie Reynolds, like, turning and Visine running down her precious, immaculate face. But, like, a little bit more of a back and forth like we saw at the beginning. But
yeah, I would have loved I would have loved one more good-natured rib of just, like, if she had turned and been like, now this is acting or something like that, you know, like, I feel like that would have been like, all right, she got you, dude. But yep. It shows that you love each other and that you're equal in this and not necessarily that she was the damsel in distress and is only fine because the man came in and saved her, even though it was their plan the whole time.
Yeah, like maybe if they had like a little more of an intimate moment instead of being in front of everyone, they would maybe would like have her or have him catch her in the lobby. Mm-hmm. And maybe having them like sort of maybe cheering her name or something. Like, I don't know. Did you guys see the Room movie?
No, the disaster.
The narrative one. There's a sequence like that at the end where I'm not going to get into it because it's actually a fun movie and might maybe worth putting on the list. But yeah. So, I mean, I think if you had something like that, that maybe would have been the other option to do it. But other than that, I mean, I think that's really the only way you could have done it there.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, obviously it doesn't ruin anything because it is a sweet moment. They come back together. They're singing to each other. She's crying. They're all happy. Just a nice, fun little bow. Happy ending.
And then they have like the Singing in the Rain billboard, which I guess is like a movie that's coming out. Like they're just going to do a new, like, I don't.
Yeah.
Like now they're the it couple in Hollywood and they're doing singing and dancing.
Yeah. That's going to be their first picture together, which I guess is this movie. So
yeah, doesn't have that ring like Lockwood and Lamont, but it'll do.
Mm-hmm. No, because what is it then? It's Lockwood and
Selden, I think, is
Selden.
It?
Yeah. Any other kind of tidbits that you guys want to get out there before we kind of put a bow on our thoughts?
I mean, for me at least, it definitely like it did what I wanted to do, which is get me excited to watch other musicals, and I hope others fall on our list and we watch some more in the future. Mm-hmm. I think all the three leads are incredible. They're just endlessly charming and they're all super talented, even like physically talented, like crazily so. A lot of the actual songs themselves, they're pretty good. But again, I think I'm more blown away by the choreography and the chemistry between the leads than I am more of like, oh, that's a banger. That's a good song. I'm going to remember that one. I mean, outside of hearing the Good Morning one and Singing in the Rain like 1,000 times in my life, mm-hmm. I can't even think of, I mean, besides looking at my paper right now, I'm not going to remember the other numbers in this movie.
Not Moses?
Sure. Bring it up next time I see you, Bridget. We'll laugh about it. All right. I can see why it's heralded as much as it is and why it's loved the way it is. Again, would love to see other musicals where I can be like, oh, okay, I can see. I mean, I hope other musicals are up to this standard of at least quality. For me, it's a thumbs up. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I definitely can see why this is regarded as one of the, if not the greatest American musical. Very happy I watched it. The sense of humor that this movie has made me feel like I had seen it many times. Like it just felt like
that classical, yeah.
That classical and just like it had been in my life forever while still also having these really impressive dance sequences that are absolutely mind-blowing. Broadway ballet, I'm in love.
Yeah, I too was pleasantly surprised by the humor in it, as I said. That I think put it over the top for me just because the dancing is impressive. It's beyond like the choreography is insane. Watching Gene and Donald O'Connor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Watching those two flail their limbs about, but with such precision, like it's so crazy, some of those, like, you know, those like steps that they do where like you're kicking and you're moving and just like you're throwing a leg out, but it's not sloppy.
It's like they're sitting on a bench and there's no bench there.
Yeah, it's incredible. And the talent alone just on the screen is so impressive that you're seeing. I mean, we talked about last week how impressive watching the cast was and doing the thing that they are good at, which is acting. This here is that, but it's also the dancing, it's the singing, it's all so impressive. But it was, you know, just a regular, it would have just been a regular musical for me if it wasn't also incredibly funny. Like some of the bits that that Cosmo does, one of my favorites, which is, there's two instances of it, when they come up with the idea, I think, to do the dubbing, and they go to RF and he's on board with the whole thing and they're in his office and Cosmo looks at him and goes, yeah, we're doing it. Here, have a cigar. And he gives him the cigar from his own desk. And then they call back to it later and he's like, to think I almost gave you a cigar. it's stuff like that where it's those little like vaudeville-esque moments where that just like, that took it to another level for me. And I had such a blast with it. It was so much fun. Well, that will do it then, I think, for this episode of Fine, I'll Watch It. Remember, you can find every episode of Fine, I'll Watch It every Thursday morning at 9 a.m. on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Stitcher, and Spotify. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Broken Clock Pod. So let us know, what are some of your favorite musicals, either Broadway, movies, television episodes where they did that very special musical episode. And what do you think of Singing in the Rain? Is it up there as one of your favorites? Make sure to let us know on Facebook and Twitter at Broken Clock Pods. But once again, for Fine, I'll Watch It, my name is Adam.
I'm Bridget.
And I'm Johnny.
And thanks so much for listening.